The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Health Letter. We're continuing the July 2024 issue. And I'm going to turn now to news briefs. And the first short article is, Can Your Blood Test Predict Your Future Risk of Stress, Anxiety, or Depression? When the doctor says your blood sugar or cholesterol levels are off, you might worry about diabetes or heart disease. But a large study published online April 2, 2024 by JAMA Network Open suggests that abnormal levels of these biomarkers might also signal a risk for developing chronic stress, anxiety, or depression years later. Researchers at facilities around the world, including Harvard, analyzed the health information of more than 211,000 people in Sweden. At the start of the study, participants were middle-aged, 42 on average, and free of chronic stress or mood disorders. Each person was tested for levels of blood sugar and fats like triglycerides and HDL. After 21 years, people who had high blood sugar and high triglycerides at the start of the study were more likely to have developed chronic stress or mood disorders by age 60, compared with people who'd had low or normal blood sugars and triglycerides. On the flip side, people who'd had high levels of HDL were less likely to develop chronic stress or mood disorders compared with people who had low levels of HDL. This study doesn't answer the question of whether abnormal levels of sugar and fats lead to chronic stress, anxiety, or depression, or if the connection is more complicated or involves other factors. We know for sure that it's important to keep levels of sugar and fats normal to reduce the risk of many diseases. The next short article is entitled, Motivate Yourself to Walk More. Need a little oomph to boost your daily step count? Try reminders or incentives, suggests a randomized controlled trial published online April 7, 2024 by Circulation. Researchers asked more than 1,000 people to wear activity trackers, walk every day, and set step goals. The average age of this group was 67. Participants were then randomly assigned in one of four groups. One group had the chance to win game points. Another had the chance to earn money. Another had the chance to get both money and game points. And another had a daily text message noting the previous day's step count. After 1 year, people in all the groups had added another 1,500 steps or more to their daily step total. But compared to the message-only group, those in the money or game groups walked about 500 more steps per day. And those in the combined incentive group walked 900 more steps per day. Want to try it at home? Set an exercise reminder on your phone and use a walking app that offers game points and rewards. The next short article is entitled, Heart Failure Might Be the Most Common Complication of Atrial Fibrillation. Doctors have long warned that atrial fibrillation, a common heart rhythm disorder, can lead to stroke. AFib describes a condition in which the heart's upper chambers beat erratically, which can make a blood pool and form clots that travel to the brain or other parts of the body. But a large observational study from Denmark, published online April 17, 2024, by the British Medical Journal, suggests that heart failure might be an even bigger risk from atrial fib. Researchers evaluated the health information of more than 3 million people who were AFib-free and followed for more than 20 years. Among people who developed atrial fibrillation during the study, Heart failure occurred about twice as often as a stroke, 41% versus 21%, and more than three times as often as a heart attack, 41% versus 12%. How does atrial fibrillation contribute to heart failure? The erratic and ineffective beating of the upper chambers of the heart probably forced the lower chambers to work harder. Over time, that toll can reduce the heart's ability to pump enough blood to meet your needs. That's one more reason why it's important to seek treatment for atrial fibrillation and minimize symptoms. The Harvard Special Health Report is worth reading. It's called Managing Atrial Fibrillation and is available at www.health.harvard.edu/AFIB. Finally, here's a short article called Using Food to Stay Hydrated. It's easy to guzzle a glistening glass of ice water on a hot summer afternoon. It quenches your thirst and cools your body as you fight the blistering heat. What's harder is routinely reaching for water and other drinks to stay hydrated each day. Maybe you don't sense that you're thirsty. You worry about frequent trips to the bathroom, or you forget to take a few sips every hour. Whatever the reason, take heart. You can make up some of the difference with food. Most foods contain at least a little bit of water. Even walnuts are 3% water. A whole wheat bagel is 38% water. And cooked salmon fillets are 65% water. But the superstars of water-rich foods are fruits and vegetables. Celery, cucumbers, and romaine lettuce are 95% water, says Nancy Oliveira, a registered dietitian and manager of the Nutrition and Wellness Service at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Other fruits and vegetables, like green grapes, peaches, and corn, are in the 70 to 90% water range. Soups, milk, yogurt, cottage cheese, and smoothies are also excellent sources of dietary fluid. The amount of fluid to consume each day from food and drink depends on your body size and health needs. The National Academy of Medicine recommends 11 cups or 88 ounces of fluid per day for women and 15 cups or 120 ounces per day for men. If that seems steep, remember that everything you drink, water, moderate amounts of caffeinated coffee or tea, juice, milk, and even drinks with a low alcohol content like beer count toward this total. Plus, a balanced diet may help contribute up to 2 cups of fluid to your daily intake. Eating the recommended 2 servings of fruits and 3 servings of vegetables might give you an additional 15 ounces of fluid every day. If staying hydrated is challenging for you, consider increasing the amount of watery foods you eat. Don't worry about calculating ounces, just up the ante a bit. Have a smoothie for breakfast made of 1 or 2 fruits and plant or dairy milk. Snack on raw veggies like grapes, an orange, or a slice of watermelon. Eat a large salad for lunch with a wide variety of colorful vegetables. Enjoy soup for dinner, and add small amounts of water-rich foods to each meal, like a handful of berries to cereal, a cup of cooked veggies to dinner, or a dollop of plain, non-fat Greek yogurt to chili or soup. No matter how much water-rich food you consume, it's still essential to drink enough fluids to stay hydrated. Water is the best choice because it has no additives, so it's absorbed quickly. Have some at each meal. Add fresh herbs like mint or basil. Tap the leaves with the end of a wooden spoon to release the flavor. Add a slice of cucumber or fruit to water. Drink it at different temperatures, chilled with ice or warm. Add a small amount of non-caloric water enhancer like Mio or Crystal Light. It might take time to find the right combination of drinks and water-rich foods to stay hydrated. Hitting the sweet spot will keep you energized, alert, and refreshed on a warm summer day or all year round. Now we're going to turn to the Harvard Women's Health Watch. This is the May issue. And there is a useful article entitled, Be a Bladder Boss. Constantly running to the bathroom, certain lifestyle changes can crush your need to flush. It's not unusual for Dr. Malika Anand to see women walk into her office toting one of those huge insulated tumblers that can hold a liter or more of water. Why are they visiting? Often it's to ask Dr. Anand why they're urinating so often. She's a urogynecologist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess. Sense a disconnect? Drinking too much water should seem an obvious reason for too frequent bathroom runs, but Dr. Anand often needs to point out the link. Defined as urinating more than 8 times a day or more than once a night, frequent urination isn't a medical condition in itself, but it's believed to be very common, affecting millions of women across the United States and hindering their everyday movements. Women will often tell me they drink 2 or 3 of those liter-sized water bottles a day or walk into clinic with a 20-ounce coffee, and then they're surprised they pee so much, she says. A host of frequent urination triggers aren't nearly as evident as fluid overload. And while not all are due to lifestyle factors, women can often tweak everyday choices to curtail a constant need for the bathroom. If your bladder often seems full, consider these other common contributors. The first, of course, is caffeine and alcohol. Drinks containing either of these substances prompt the kidneys to produce urine. Both act as bladder irritants, increasing the urge to urinate. Then there are carbonated drinks. These can also irritate the bladder. Keep in mind that clear seltzer is no better than soda in this regard. People are trying to be healthier by drinking seltzer, but when you ask about water intake, they count seltzer, and it's not the same thing as pure water, Dr. Anand says. Artificial sweeteners. Whether in food or drink, some of these additives are yet another bladder irritant, which can make you go to the restroom even before your bladder is full, she says. Certain medications. Common bladder bloaters include diuretics, some blood pressure drugs, some antidepressants, and benzodiazepines. Pregnancy. No mystery surrounds how carrying a growing fetus makes women urinate more, since the expanding uterus presses on the bladder and reduces how much it can hold. Then there's aging. Estrogen receptors line the bladder and urethra. Diminished estrogen during perimenopause and beyond can increase urinary frequency and urgency by causing your bladder to feel full sooner. Uncontrolled diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, urinary tract infections, and some neurologic conditions can trigger excess urination in a variety of ways. In diabetes, the kidneys produce more urine in an attempt to filter out excess blood sugar. In sleep apnea, the oxygen-deprived brain signals the kidneys to increase blood volume, to circulate more oxygen around the body, and a portion of that blood volume turns to urine. Then there's anxiety. Feeling anxious can cause muscles around the bladder to contract, provoking the urge to urinate. If changing what or how much you drink doesn't lower the number of times you urinate every day, consider seeing a doctor. Other telling signs you need a medical evaluation include sudden changes in frequency, pain with urination, occasional incontinence, a bulge in your vagina, or the feeling you can't empty your bladder completely. Your doctor can also determine if you have overactive bladder, a condition marked by sudden, uncontrolled urges to urinate. Overactive bladder, or OAB, is diagnosed only after eliminating other reasons for frequent urination. As many as 40% of women in the United States deal with OAB symptoms, which occur more often in women than men, according to the American Urologic Association. Treating OAB starts with the same lifestyle changes mentioned above that help anyone who feels they are urinating too often. For persisting symptoms, your doctor can recommend specific therapies related to the reasons for your overactive bladder. Now we're going to turn to the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. This is the May 2024 issue. And the article is going to focus on bloating. There's a discomfort in your belly. It's more than just feeling full. You belch enough to annoy your friends, and you also pass gas, but neither brings significant relief. You feel like you're pregnant, but you're well past that stage of life. Bloating isn't a condition, but more of a symptom of one. Although feeling full is a common description of bloating, people experience bloating in various ways. It generally refers to a sensation of pressure that sometimes is accompanied by measurable swelling or distension of the abdomen, as if someone attached a bicycle pump and filled your belly with air. 14% of American adults report having felt bloated in the past week, according to a large study. Bloating was more common in women and in those with digestive conditions like irritable bowel syndrome, chronic constipation, or lactose malabsorption. The study also found that more than half of people who felt bloated didn't seek out medical advice. Don't feel bashful about seeking medical care for bloating. It can be as treatable as it is common, and it often can be significantly helped by making small changes to your diet and your lifestyle, or addressing the underlying condition that's causing the bloating. Managing it requires you to take an active role in your care. Before you seek medical care for bloating, spend a few days or weeks jotting down notes about associated symptoms and factors, like food or beverages you've consumed, the form and frequency of your stool, and your physical activity. Details kept in a symptom journal can be a big help. Bring the symptom journal to your healthcare visit to review with your care team. Your care team may go through a detailed history to determine what's causing the bloating and offer possible treatments. First, it's important to rule out other factors. One pseudo-bloat factor is abdominal obesity. A key difference is that most bloating will change over time, while carrying extra fat around the middle generally remains the same, day after day. Also, several medical conditions can cause fluid to collect in the abdomen. This can be a feature of ovarian cancer, so don't overlook this if it's persistent. Your care team can check for these issues with a physical exam or imaging. A review of medications is often part of the exam. Many medications and supplements can cause bloating, but common culprits include supplements containing fiber, iron, or magnesium, diabetes drugs like metformin, constipation drugs like lactulose, elixirs used for tube feeding, and opioid pain medications. Doctors at the Mayo Clinic in Florida offer an approach for diagnosing the cause of bloating that rules out certain common causes in the following order. First, they consider diet and behaviors. Dietary factors are a common cause of bloating and can be treated successfully with small changes to what you eat and when. For example, 35% of adults are lactose intolerant, a common cause of bloating. Certain habits can contribute, especially gum chewing, drinking from a straw, drinking carbonated beverages, eating too quickly, and other things that lead to excess air swallowing, like using a CPAP device for sleep apnea. Then there's constipation. Constipation is commonly associated with bloating and abdominal distension. If it's difficult to pass stool, it may be difficult to pass gas as well. In addition, it's important to note if you frequently have feelings of incomplete passing of stool, or if you sometimes have to manually assist the passing of stool. If constipation seems like it may be a factor, taking medications to reduce constipation or performing exercises to strengthen the pelvic floor muscles may help with bloating. Then there's small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. This condition occurs when there is an abnormal increase in the overall bacterial population in the small intestine, particularly types of bacteria not commonly found in that part of the digestive tract. Overgrowth commonly results when a health situation, like having bowel anatomy that's altered by surgery, or a dysfunction of the nerves or muscles that lead to the intestinal muscles contracting or relaxing improperly, a motility disorder, affects the passage of food and waste products in the digestive tract. This situation creates a breeding ground for bacteria. Healthcare professionals test for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth by obtaining a sample of fluid from the small intestine and then analyzing the fluid for bacterial growth. Or a breath test may be used to measure the amount of hydrogen or methane that you breathe out after drinking a mixture of glucose and water. Specific antibiotics are the first-line treatment for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Antibiotics reduce the overall small bowel bacterial level. Then there's an impaired viscerosomatic reflex. That's viscerosomatic. This reflex controls gas clearance and involves the contraction and relaxation of muscles in the diaphragm and the abdominal wall. The diaphragm descends inappropriately and the abdominal wall muscles relax, allowing the abdomen to protrude. People with this condition tend to be less bloated in the morning before they've eaten, but symptoms worsen shortly after meals. Passing stool can help ease symptoms, but things get worse again after the next snack or meal. Stress can also make bloating worse. Practice deep belly breathing can sometimes help ease bloating if you have this condition. You should not ignore persistent bloating. With proper diagnosis and treatment, you may be able to return to living your usual life with manageable bloating. But due to the potentially serious implications, be sure not to take problematic and persistent bloating as a fact of life. A visit to your healthcare team can help to identify the cause and get it treated. Now here's a couple of short articles from News and Our Views. And the first is entitled, Breast Cancer Overdiagnosis, an Issue for Older Women. And of course, this comes from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. Diagnosing breast cancer accurately and early is very important, but equally important is avoiding overdiagnosis, in which a diagnosis leads to treatments that can sometimes negatively affect quality of life without actually extending life. A recent study found that overdiagnosis may be more common than previously thought in older women. The study in the Annals of Internal Medicine looked at the health records of 55,000 women. It found that one-third to one-half of older women diagnosed with breast cancer may have been overdiagnosed. One measurement the study used, women who weren't screened for breast cancer in their late years were no more likely to die of the disease than those who were screened. Those most prone to being overdiagnosed were 85 and older. Of course, it's tricky to understand who's overdiagnosed. Overdiagnosis means the cancer will grow slowly enough that it won't have a negative effect on the person during their lifetime. In that case, diagnosing and treating the cancer, which comes with significant disruption to life and health and tends to be expensive, may not be advised. Mayo Clinic experts say that while the study offers important insights about overdiagnosis, patients would benefit from a more holistic consideration of the topic. It's important to make informed choices about your particular screening situation. Talk with your healthcare team about your risk factors for breast cancer and other serious conditions, your overall health, your family health, and other factors. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force now recommends that all women get screened for breast cancer every other year from age 40 through age 74, although some other organizations, including the Mayo Clinic, still recommend annual screenings for most women in this age range. Women 75 and older are encouraged to discuss the benefits and risks of screening with their care team. No standard recommendations are given for women in this age group. And then very briefly, there is an article about olive oil for dementia. In a study reported in the 2023 annual meeting of the American Society for Nutrition, researchers looked at food frequency questionnaires from 90,000 Americans over three decades. The researchers found that people who reported consuming half a tablespoon of olive oil or more a day lowered their odds of developing dementia by 28% when compared with people who rarely had olive oil. The researchers also found that swapping even a teaspoon of margarine or mayonnaise for olive oil every day reduced the risk of dying of dementia. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.